Good to see you, Northview Church. I want to make a special welcome to you here in Carmel, and also you in Lafayette, and you in Fishers. It's great to be with you this weekend as well. So we come to the epicenter of the story. This week, this is all about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is the single greatest act in human history. Hear this. Jesus' death was a tragedy until the resurrection. You see, we tend to look at the cross of Christ backwards through the lens of history, through the resurrection, but without the resurrection, the cross gets its power because 3 days later, Jesus rose from the grave. I have a picture I want to show you that's right over here. I think we're going to bring it up here on this screen. This is a picture of me just a few months ago standing outside a tomb. This is in Palestine, in the Holy Land. I took about 34 of you from Northview Church, and we went over and did a study tour in around Jerusalem. And I'll tell you what, this morning was an amazing morning for me. So there are two locations in the Holy Land that are contenders for the space, the actual physical space where Jesus was crucified and then laid in a grave and then 3 days later rose again. There's two locations potential. One of them is underneath a building, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, this church building that was built, some of it, in the 4th century. Helena, Constantine's mother, is the one that commissioned that work there in the Holy Land. It's an amazing building. You can still see some of the work that the workers that she hired did to build that church building. That's probably, we're in the ballpark there, where Jesus was crucified, buried, and raised. But there's this spot just outside of Jerusalem. It's called Gordon's Calvary. It's called the Garden Tomb. Gordon was an English man, and in 1867, he looked out his window, and he saw from his hotel window the side of a cliff that he thought looked like a skull, Golgotha. So they started digging around, and they found this tomb. It's an old tomb, dates back to about that same time. This is probably not the tomb that Jesus was laid in, but still, what a powerful moment to stand there. It reminded me, as I was standing there and later as I was sitting down and just kind of thinking about that experience, of a quote that I've heard before. I want to share this quote with you. This is by C.S. Lewis. He says this, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." I was thinking about this quote, and I went back to the hotel room, and I was just thinking, yeah, that's true. I see evidences of Christianity in you, evidences of Christianity in God's people. I even see evidences of my faith in the creation that God has created. I see it by that. I was thinking about the resurrection and how you could almost insert that word in here as well. I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. You see, this story, the one we're looking at today, this is the epicenter of the story. Have you been reading through the story? Did you read chapter 27 this last week? I hope you did. If you didn't, please go back and dog-ear that chapter. This week, make sure you carve out some time to dive into that chapter. You have plenty of time because we're actually going to take a pause point here. We're going to put a bookmark in the story. And for the next several weeks, we're going to be gearing up for our spiritual growth campaign. We'll be taking a break from the story during that time. And so you won't need to read chapter 28 until we come back around the 1st of November. And we'll wrap up the last four chapters then. So you have plenty of time to go back if you haven't had a chance to read chapter 27. You need to do it. Because if you don't, it's kind of like reading a novel where you skip that chapter where the climax happens and all the good stuff is revealed. That's what chapter 27 is. It's kind of the middle. It's everything leads up to that point. The whole rest of the Bible, in my opinion, can be interpreted through chapter 27. The resurrection of Jesus Christ makes the whole rest of the story make sense. Now, we're going to dive into the story. We're going to look at some of the characters in the resurrection, and we're going to look and see how the resurrection changed them. They were this kind of person perhaps before that moment. Jesus dies, raises from the grave, and they're a different kind of person for the rest of their life. While we look at these folks, though, and we look for evidences of that kind of life change in their life, I'm going to invite yourself to be looking inward and asking, how is the resurrection changing you? Now, I'm not just talking about 20 years ago when you first made that decision to follow Jesus, but how is the resurrection changing you today? Are there some areas in your life that he's working on even right now? Because here's the thing. The resurrection, when you're confronted with the truth of Jesus raising from the dead, it has to change you. So let's jump into the chapter. This chapter is a two-part story. In my opinion, you can divide this part of the story up into two parts, the before and after. Let's look first at the before. If you're taking notes, you might want to write this down. Part one of the story is this. Saturday was a no hope, no courage day. Let me say that again. Saturday was a no hope, no courage day. Saturday morning, the sun comes up. And if the disciples had gone to bed that night, I don't know if they did. They were still on a bit of a grief hangover, if you will, from the day before, Friday. Now, we don't need to rehash the events of Friday. We looked at that last week. And if you read chapter 26 of the story, you get what happened on Friday. But Saturday morning, they're still feeling the effects of Friday. We read at the beginning of our chapter on page 381 how they are feeling grief. Listen to these words, taking Jesus' body, the two of them, this is Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, wrapped it, Jesus' body, with the spices and strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden, and in this garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and because the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. Now, did you catch underneath those words? They had to start the process of preparing him for his burial. They couldn't finish it because the Sabbath was approaching. So the disciples, those followers of Jesus, these guys, one of them is even a secret disciple. He hadn't let that be known that he was a follower of Jesus. They start the process of getting him ready for the grave, but they can't finish it. They started the process of what is a normal human reaction to death. We grieve. I'm sure that many of us in this space have lost a loved one, and we know what that feels like to hurt, to feel that kind of grief, pain. The disciples did. Saturday was a no hope, no courage day. They were grieving. Now, I've lost family members, I've lost friends, but I've never seen a good friend mocked. I've never seen a good friend beaten within an inch of his life. I've never seen a good friend crucified and had to watch that gruesome death in front of me. So I don't know if I can feel exactly how they felt, but they're feeling grief. Grief is grief, pain is pain. So they experience the pain of losing their friend, but we get a clue as we look a little further in the story that their pain goes a little bit deeper than that. This is page 382 of the story. When the Sabbath was over, so this is Sunday, but this gives us a clue to how they were feeling on Saturday. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, there's too many Marys in this story to keep up, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Why? They didn't believe he was going to come back. They went to begin the process after the Sabbath is over of anointing his body for burial because they'd given up hope. They weren't holding out for the resurrection. They were taking care of his body just like they would have taken care of their uncle's body when his body died. Now, this is important to recognize because when you think about the disciples, they've just spent all day, every day with this teacher for 3 years. Now, and the disciples, when they chose to follow Jesus, well, they didn't have a whole lot of other options. They're working a trade and they're, you know, doing fishing perhaps. They're a carpenter and Jesus comes to them and says, drop your nets, follow me. And they do. And he becomes their everything for 3 years. They've given up hope, which is profound, because they believed that he was Jesus. They believed he was the Messiah. They believed he was the Christ of God, and he was going to save their people from their sins. They've given up hope. Profound giving up hope there. They're in danger of losing their faith. They've not just lost a friend, they're in danger of losing their faith. Mark chapter 9, verse 31, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." Get this. "But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it." They didn't understand what was going on. They thought in that moment, I really believe on Saturday, the disciples believed that they had bought into a lie, that he wasn't who he said he was. Profound grief. They've lost their compass. Now, his enemies were afraid that he was who he said he was. If you remember in the story, Pontius Pilate and the religious leaders of the Jews, they sealed the stone, they posted a guard. They were afraid. They were afraid of what might happen. They were afraid he might come back from the dead. Now, for the leaders, this is a political problem. For the disciples, they're invested. So this, for them, this is a crisis of their faith. How about you? Have you ever experienced a Saturday? Have you ever woken up and it's Saturday in your life? For our Carmel campus, we all woke up this morning and it was Saturday. I'm talking metaphorically. Have you ever experienced profound loss? I have. I want to tell you about a couple of times like that in my life. I was almost 17 years old. I was actually 16, 3 days before my 17th birthday. And I'll never forget that morning. The details are just etched into my memory. I was woken up at about 5 o'clock. My dad shook my shoulder and woke me up. And we got into the car and we raced from there through the dark morning. We didn't talk. We were on our way to the hospital because we'd gotten word that my mom was pretty close to dying. Now, this wasn't a new experience for us because there had been a few false alarms. My mom had been struggling with cancer for about 7 years at that point. And horrible, horrible disease. I remember walking into the room, the hospital room. And just as soon as we crossed the threshold, I watched my mom in her frail body that's racked with cancer. She was in horrible pain at that point, out of her mind with pain. I remember watching her chest rise and fall for the last time. We were there just the moment she breathed her last breath. And I remember feeling so just angry and frustrated. I walked around the corner into that little attached bathroom. I wanted to get away from all the people that were in there. We knew the medical staff. She'd been in and out of the hospital for quite a while. So I wanted to be alone, and I went in there, and I just remember staring down into this toilet. And I spit in the toilet. I didn't know what else to do. I was hurt. I was angry. And I was struggling with this question. How can a good God allow bad things to happen to good people? Saturday, hurt, pain. It's a no hope, no courage day. Skip ahead several years. I had another Saturday morning, if you will. I remember waking up. And that was the morning that we were giving our daughter over. You see, several months before that, my wife and I had decided that we wanted to be Christians with their sleeves rolled up. We wanted to dive into the fight. We wanted to be a part of redeeming children from neglect and brokenness. And so we became foster parents. And we had told the caseworkers that we wanted to foster to adopt. And so please give us children that maybe is going towards termination of parental rights because we would be willing to adopt. That's what we want. And that was the plan. And they gave us a beautiful little baby girl. Her name is Brooklyn. And she was with us for several months. And her mom was a drug addict. Actually, her mom was incarcerated when Brooklyn was born. And Brooklyn had some effects from the drug use. It was pretty much a slam dunk case. There was no chance she was going back with her mom. Her mom had already lost two other children because of abuse and neglect in two other states. I won't bore you with the details. It's a little bit confusing. But that didn't happen the way we planned. And I found myself that day standing there next to my wife, my son, little boy, 3, 4 years old, thinking, oh my goodness, what have we done to him? As we handed this little bundle of joy over to the caseworker. And she left. And I remember standing in the shower and feeling the water just kind of run over me. I felt numb. God, why? Why? Have you ever been there? Have you ever felt that? Have you ever had a Saturday, a no hope, no courage day? The temptation here is to move too quickly through Saturday. As Christians, we're really good at this. We'll put on a sunshine face. We'll use cliches like, this too shall pass. But could we just take a moment and acknowledge that Saturday stinks. Saturday is horrible. John chapter 16, verse 33, Jesus actually promises that there will be Saturdays. He says, in this world, you will have trouble. It still catches me by surprise when I wake up and it's Saturday. I love the way that verse continues, though. It doesn't stop there. Jesus says, in this world, you will have trouble, but take heart. I have overcome the world. You might feel that today is the darkest day, and it very well might be. Today might be your Saturday, but take heart, because tomorrow I'm going to pull off Easter. I'm going to beat the power of Satan, sin, death, and hell. I'm going to raise from the grave to life. Which brings us to the second part of this story. If you're taking notes, go ahead and write this down. Sunday brought a new kind of life. Duh. Jesus rose from the grave, right? Of course, it's a new kind of life. I'm not just talking about his life. I'm talking about a new kind of life that was brought to all of his followers. There's a marked contrast between before and after the resurrection and how these people acted. Let's go ahead and pick back up the story, shall we? This is page 383 of the story. It says this, so Peter and the other disciple, I believe this is John, because this is from the Gospel of John. Peter and the other disciple, John, started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. Let's pause there for a second. I love this. I love the kind of insight you can see into the humanity that goes into the writing of Scripture. Ladies, if you have ever had a doubt that men can compete over anything, this right here is your proof. He inserts in there, I got there first. Single greatest moment in all of human history, and he's bragging that he outran Peter, who's probably a little overweight, a little bit out of shape. So John, he bent over and looked in. He's there first. He looks in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. I love this too, because we get an insight here into Peter's personality. He pushes John out of the way. He runs in. Let me see this thing. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, he gets it in there a second time. I love this guy. Also went inside. He saw and believed. Did you catch that? He saw and he believed. There's a parenthetical note there in the text. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. But John saw and he believed. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. Skip ahead a few paragraphs in the story. That very same day, there's a couple of guys walking along the road to Emmaus, outside of Jerusalem. And they're walking along and they're talking about all the things that have happened in Jerusalem over the last several days. And a stranger comes up and starts walking with them. We know that this is Jesus. They don't yet. Jesus has not revealed himself to them. They're telling the story. Yeah, these ladies, they get up, some of the ladies, they go to the tomb first and they find that it's empty and they come back and they tell. And then Peter and John have this foot race and John gets there first and they find that the tomb is empty. What do you think this means? Listen to this, page 384. Jesus said to them, "How foolish you are, how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." They invite him to stay with them for the night at this place that they're stopping to spend the night. And so they're sitting around, they're talking more, and then the text tells us, page 385, "Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight," just like that. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" So then these two followers of Jesus, they run back to Jerusalem and they tell the disciples, "Listen, it's true. The Lord is risen. We've seen him." So now the disciples are talking about this. They're inside of a room and all of a sudden Jesus shows up. Can you feel the hope and the courage start to swell in this story? Yesterday was a no hope, no courage day, but today, he's alive. And we keep seeing him, and there's more evidence that he's here. He's alive. Page 386. "Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came." We don't know why he wasn't there, but he missed out. "So the other disciples told him, 'We have seen the Lord.' But he said to them, 'Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe.' A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas," who by this point is nicknamed Doubting Thomas, "Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, 'Peace be with you.' Then he said to Thomas, 'Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side where that Roman spear went up into the chest cavity and pierced the pericardium and blood and water flowed. See that, feel that. Stop doubting and believe.' Thomas said to him, 'My Lord and my God.'" He sees Jesus for who he is. "Then Jesus told him, 'Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Who's he talking about there? He's talking about others who are in and around the area of Jerusalem who didn't get to see Jesus. Jesus showed himself to a whole bunch of people between the moment he raised from the dead and the moment he ascended into heaven. But there were some who didn't get to see him and they believed the eyewitness account of these eyewitnesses that told them, "We've seen the risen Lord. You put him to death. He beat the power of Satan, sin, death, and hell. He's alive." And they believed. He's also talking about us. By extension, today, we are people who have not seen him. I haven't yet seen the risen Lord in his resurrected body. I can't wait to get to heaven and see that. I can't wait. But I've believed. He's talking about us by extension. Listen to this. You very well might live next door to Doubting Thomas. He lives somewhere in your neighborhood. Somewhere in your sphere of influence, you have a Doubting Thomas. And you know how this person's going to see Jesus? Through you. They're looking to see Jesus in and through you. You have to be Jesus to that person. If you're taking notes, write this down. Hear this. The greatest insult to the resurrection of Jesus Christ is passivity. Let me say that again. The greatest insult to the resurrection of Jesus Christ is, When we go rah, rah on Easter Sunday, and by Tuesday, Wednesday, Now we're back. Life is busy. And we miss the power of the resurrection in our daily life. That did not happen with the early Christians. There's a movement that exploded on the scene in and around Jerusalem, and it began there and exploded all over the world, the known world of that time. James, the brother of Christ. You know, James very well might be the strongest argument for the deity of Christ. And when does James show up in the story? After the resurrection. Think about this. What would you have to do to prove it if you told your brother, listen, I'm God? You'd have to come back from the grave, right? I mean, I think about my brothers. There's no way they're buying that unless I pulled off something as miraculous as rising from the dead. James believes, the brother of Jesus. And his life is changed from that moment forward. He devotes himself wholly to the cause of Christ and furthering his kingdom here on earth. Skip ahead in the story toward the end of this chapter, page 387. There's this moment where Jesus is restoring Peter. Remember, Peter denied Jesus three times. The rooster crowed. Jesus is gently restoring Peter, and he's asking him a question, and he's telling him three times, feed my sheep. Perhaps you remember that story. The third time, Jesus says this, feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. We get a little bit of a hint there about what Peter's life and death has in store for him. Now, if you're somebody who's looking for historical evidence of the resurrection, there's plenty that exists. Let me give you a resource. We don't have time to dive into that today, but if you'd like to study some of that on your own, let me recommend a couple of different books to you, both by the same author. His name is Lee Strobel, and Lee Strobel is a journalist, and he approaches these two books. One is called The Case for Christ. The other one is called A Case for Easter. He approaches these books through a journalistic lens and kind of walks you through a systematic series of evidences that we see in the historical record that Jesus is who he said he was, that he died, that he rose from the grave. But for me, it's always been, and I think it always will be, the greatest evidence of the resurrection for me is the eyewitnesses. What they did. Their lives were forever changed. They saw Jesus die. They saw him raised from the dead, and they gave their lives and they gave their deaths to following him. I want to share with you just a few examples of, these are the disciples. There are many, many, many martyrs that happened in those first couple of centuries. Our faith, our history, is a pretty bloody history during that time period. But for the disciples, we have evidence from Christian history that all but 11, okay, so Judas betrays Jesus, we've discounted him. The 11 that are left, one of them, according to Christian tradition, dies a natural death. Now, he's exiled on an island. He doesn't get to hang out with his family and his friends. He's exiled, but he dies a natural death. The rest of them, according to tradition, die martyrs' deaths. They so firmly believe they saw Jesus dead and they saw him alive. I want to tell you about just a few of these. This is coming from a couple of sources. One is Hippolytus of Rome. He's an early church father. He died in 236 AD. Another one is from a guy by the name of Eusebius. These are his writings. He's the bishop of Caesarea. He lived from 260 to about 341 AD. This is what they say. Andrew, one of the 12, was crucified and buried in Greece. According to Hippolytus, Bartholomew preached in India and was crucified with his head down. Hippolytus also identified that James, son of Alphaeus, was stoned to death by the Jews in Jerusalem and buried by the temple. James, son of Zebedee, according to the book of Acts in the New Testament, he was killed by Herod, chapter 12. Eusebius describes in more detail that something was actually cut off of James. He says this, these are his words. First, Stephen was stoned to death by them, and after him, James, the son of Zebedee and the brother of John, was beheaded. According to Hippolytus, Philip preached and was executed, was crucified in what today is eastern Turkey. Hippolytus records that Thomas, Remember Thomas? Doubting Thomas was an active missionary, and that he met his fate in India. I want to read to you Hippolytus' words about Thomas. And Thomas preached to the Parthians, Medes, Persians, Hyrcanians, Bactrians, and Margians, and was thrust, listen to this, thrust through in the four members of his body with a pine spear at Kalamene, the city of India, and was buried there. Peter, remember Jesus predicted how Peter would die. Hippolytus confirmed that, in fact, that Peter was crucified by Nero in Rome. These are his words. Peter preached the gospel in Pontus and Galatia and Cappadocia and Bithynia and Italy and Asia, and was afterwards crucified by Nero in Rome with his head downward, as he had himself suffered or desired to suffer in that manner. Why? Why? You don't go to your death, especially a horrible, gruesome death like those. You don't do that to cover up a lie. You do that because your life's been changed, because you believe in the power of the resurrection. These are eyewitnesses who saw Jesus dead, and then they saw him alive. And I want you to notice, it changed their lives. The Apostle Paul talks about this in Philippians chapter 3, verse 10. He says, I want to know Christ. Yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, so somehow attaining to the resurrection of the dead. Here's the question. What needs to die inside of you so that he can live outside of you? Here's the biggest question. If you're taking notes, go ahead and circle this one. Here's the question. How is the resurrection of Jesus Christ changing me? How is it changing me? Here's another way to ask that. What is being resurrected in me? What that once was dead is he bringing to life? What is that thing? What is that in you? I want to tell you the rest of the story. It's not finished. He's still doing a good work in my life. I told you the beginning of a couple of stories in my life. I told you about a couple of Saturdays. Well, Sunday's come, and I'm still living in Sunday, and I'm still growing. I want to tell you where that's working in my life. So I told you about my mom. And I grieved that. Truth be told, I was young. I was almost 17. It rocked my world. Several years later, one of my Bible college professors kind of grabbed me. We were talking, and he had known my mom, and so he was talking about her, and I think he was trying to minister to me, encourage me. And I responded to one of his questions with, these were my words, yeah, she was a good woman. And he stopped, and he turned, and he looked me square in the eyes, and he corrected me. I'm so glad he did. He said, no, your tense is wrong. It's not that she was a good woman. No, we serve the God of the living, not the God of the dead. She was alive in Christ. She died in Christ, so she is a good woman. I believe that to the core of my being. And I can't wait one of these days in heaven to give my mom a big hug. Can't wait to do that. But more than that, I can't wait to look at my Savior and see him in his resurrected body. He who makes it possible to have that kind of a reunion. I can't wait for that. So I live with hope. The Apostle Paul says, we grieve, but we don't grieve as those who have no hope. I have hope. And I have a bit of courage. Saturday was a no hope, no courage day, but let me tell you this. So I was a shy kid. I was. Maybe partly because of the circumstances at home and some of the things that my mom was dying. But I was a shy kid. And I remember vividly going to church week after week after week. And at that point of time, at the end of the service, every week we offered an invitation in my home church. And the way we did it is we stood up and we sang together, and there was a moment where we were called to come forward. And I would stand there, I'm not kidding you, every week, week after week after week, probably for a couple of years, maybe longer. I would stand there in that moment in time and I would just kind of like start to shake. And I would sweat. And I would think, I want this, but I'm so scared to go up front. So scared to have everybody look at me. I was shy. Now, I don't miss the irony in that, that I stand here right now in front of probably 1,000 of you, and I'm telling you my confession of faith. I believe this to the core of who I am. Down to the depth of my being, I believe that Jesus died. And I believe that he rose from the grave, and I believe that I have access to the Father because of his death, burial, and resurrection. I believe in him. And I'll do whatever it takes to encourage you, to challenge you, to believe in him as well. Jesus is redeeming something else in me in this area. My childhood wasn't all fairy dust and pixie dust, right? I mean, my parents were great. They were. They did their best. But it took 7 years for mom to die. Let me put it this way. I had to grow up too fast. And I think I missed out on some of my childhood. I'm just now beginning to come to terms with some of what that did inside of me and how that's affected me in my life. Just now starting to work through some of that stuff. God is redeeming this in me now through my kids. I have some kids. Actually, I want to show you a picture. This is a picture of my kids. So there's one homegrown and four of them that are adopted. Remember I told you the story of adoption. Let me tell you where this picture is taking place at. This is actually over the strip in Las Vegas, Nevada. We're on this kind of walkway there. I made them stand there. It was a sweltering hot day, and I made them just stand there and let me take their picture. Why? Well, it's because in that space, actually, about 8 years ago, a little bit longer, my wife and I stood there. One of my first ministries was in Las Vegas. And this summer we took this trip and we went out to see some friends from previous ministries and mentors. And I made my kids stand there. You can't see it, but about 20 feet over here, there's a drunk guy kind of passed out on the sidewalk. But I made them stand there because that's the spot. My wife and I had been praying and we'd been fasting. She'd already made the decision. But for me, this was the moment. I burned the bridges behind me and said, now, you know what? We're going to bring all these kids in. And we're going to give them a home because they don't have a home. We're going to show them love because they don't feel a lot of love right now. We want to be Jesus to them. In that moment, in that space, Jesus was resurrecting something inside of me. And I still see him doing it as I spend time with my kids. He's still resurrecting something that was dead, something broken inside of me. How about you?